6:05, good to have you this Tuesday morning. Good morning to you, Jamie.
Morning.
Lots to talk about today. And Tigers lose last night to the White Sox, 6-4. They lost 2 out of 3 to the Pale Hosts.
To, like, a terrible team.
Jason, do you have any, can you provide any sort of color? Or, that was Sunday. There you go. Turn the mic on.
It's embarrassing to lose to the White Sox. Even though the White Sox offense has been pretty good, but still.
Yeah, well.
Still.
It's still really rough. They are back at it tonight against the Yankees and the Bronx. So we'll watch how that thing plays out. Meanwhile, this drawing has been released by the House Committee investigating the Epstein situation. And I don't really know what to make of it.
It's gross.
I don't know what it tells me.
I think it doesn't prove anything, but it shows a relationship. And it also shows the Wall Street Journal was correct when they reported it.
Yeah, it shows that they had some sort of information. And really what it is lines, essentially, of Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein. It's outlined by a silhouette of what looks to be a woman.
A naked woman.
Yeah.
And then his signature is at the bottom. And he's saying, Caroline Leavitt saying, this is fake. Well, this came to the Oversight Committee from the Epstein estate. So it's not like it came from some...
Right, third party.
Right.
Something like that.
Came from the estate. The only thing you could argue now is this was put in this birthday book in 2003 and Donald Trump didn't know it. That's the only thing you can argue now. It's not a fake Democrat hoax like Caroline Leavitt says.
No, it doesn't appear to be. And now, of course, there's an examination of his signature. And we'll get into it a little bit more in a couple of minutes. But this push is not over to try to get the information, to try to get this committee to release more information. And then certainly the victims have made their voices heard on this, too. So just something to watch.
The Supreme Court making news yesterday, overturning a federal judge's order that had sort of tied the hands of federal agents in Los Angeles, stopping people, questioning them about their immigration status based solely on their ethnicity and like just thinking they might be here illegally. The lower court is saying that violated the Fourth Amendment because you're supposed to have reasonable suspicion that, you know, something illegal is going on, not that it's just a person speaking Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
But the Supreme Court is saying it's okay, you can go forward while the litigation continues to go forward. Like, it goes back to the lower courts now.
Yeah, and this has kind of been the Supreme Court's MO, is they've made these kind of decisions and then they kick them back down to the lower court levels on a number of these
issues.
Yeah,
except Justice Kavanaugh talked a little bit about the substance of the case, which makes you think that he's tipped his hand of how they would rule if it ever gets back up there, mm-hmm. saying that this is reasonable, that it's okay to stop people for those reasons and not because you think they broke the law. He said, quote, as for stops of those individuals who are legally in the country, the questioning in those circumstances is typically brief, and those individuals may promptly go free after making clear to the immigration officers that they are U.S. citizens or otherwise legally in the United States. But we've heard these accounts of these people being in custody for like 2 weeks
mm-hmm.
or taken here, taken there, and they are U.S. citizens. That's a violation.
There's also this, you know, talk of sending National Guard troops to Chicago, which we'll get into in just a minute. But now there is an expanded ICE effort in Chicago as well as ICE crackdowns have hit Colorado a little harder than they had in previous weeks. Department of Homeland Security saying in an online statement that the Operation Midway Blitz was being conducted by ICE officials. But in terms of really the full scope of it, we don't know yet. But they are expanding their footprint, ISIS.
And this ruling from the Supreme Court allows them to just stop people for any reason they think they should.
Mm. How about this story? This is a cool one. In Wayne, over here in Wayne State's campus, just a couple of minutes away from the Fisher Building, they're going to break down ground today on a $200 million research facility. 160,000 square feet. There will be different researchers, science disciplines, different discoveries, health issues in people in Detroit, across the state, across the country, oncology, neuroscience, biology, immunology, metabolism, infectious diseases, all things that'll be studied here at this new facility at Wayne State.
Excellent. I hope they get some federal funding.
I hope they absolutely get federal funding. Sure. I hope they get all the funding that they can get.
Yeah, sure. Research is important.
Yes, it is.
There's a new NBC News Desk poll, and it shows a couple things. First of all, 78%, that's the share of U.S. adults who say they strongly or somewhat support the use of vaccines to prevent disease. The poll was conducted before this whole, like, thing on Capitol Hill with RFK. 45% of respondents said that inflation and the cost of living are the economic issues most important to them and their families right now. No other choice even came close when it comes to that. And 18 points. That's the gap between Gen Z men and Gen Z women on a cultural question. When it comes to getting ahead in the workplace, do they think it's better to be a man or a woman, or does it make a difference? What do you think the men and women said?
I would assume doesn't make a difference.
The men said it doesn't make a difference. Mm-hmm. The women were divided. A close majority, 51% saying gender doesn't make a difference when getting ahead, and then the rest said that it does.
I will say, I think it's a generational thing. Like I'll be 37 this year. It doesn't surprise me when there's a woman in power. It doesn't surprise me when there's a woman who has a high profile job. That is inconsequential to me. Like, I don't look at it like that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't compute. And I understand, like, when Barack Obama was elected president, I understand. Like, I get it logically why that's a big deal. It didn't move the needle for me. Because, of course, because that's not the world that I grew up in, where you just don't see people of whatever background being able to do a job. So I think it's generational. I don't think it's as the poll shows that doesn't impact people's decision making or thinking anymore.
When it comes to male and female, there's still a divide. There's a pay gap always. Mm-hmm. And there's not as many like women in the C-suite at the top. That's still a thing.
Sure.
But this shows that a lot of women, at least in their jobs and they're moving up, they don't feel it if it's 51%. But half of them do. 49 do.
Yeah, sure.
One more thing about this poll is the Gen Z men and women were asked, the question of whether the definition of a success includes having children. And a lot of men said yes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these women said no, which is crazy to me.
But the definition of success, though, right?
The definition of success includes having children.
Interesting. And they say no to that.
Well, it goes down, political, of course.
Yeah.
And a lot of the women said no, that's not part of success. I think a successful life, thank God I have this child because I love her so much,
sure,
is part of the success of my life.
Yeah, certainly. All right, we'll take a break. More coming up. The Epstein stuff isn't going away. We'll talk about it on JR Morning. All right, so this Epstein story isn't going away. And now the House committee that is investigating has released a document, this drawing that was talked about, that shows, or at least allegedly shows, the relationship between Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein going back many, many years.
Decade. 2003. Birthday book.
This was described as a seismograph. There is different signatures in this book, certainly, but this particular passage shows first names only, Donald Trump and Jeff, or it says Donald and Jeffrey, and almost like a conversation, like lines in a play, back and forth, Donald, Jeffrey, Donald, Jeffrey. And then at the end, it is signed. And one of the things that the White House is claiming now is that the company who owns the Wall Street Journal News Corp is going to get sued because of defamation. This is not Donald Trump's signature. Mm-hmm. This isn't anything that Donald Trump has to do with.
This is too weird not to be true. Okay. This was a birthday book that all his friends sent that Ghislaine Maxwell put together. This is so odd. The drawing, the outline of the woman's figure, the poem that ends with, "A pal is a wonderful thing. Happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret. Donald." It's just, you can't make this up.
I guess the thing is, you don't, the contents of this illustration doesn't really tell you anything. It doesn't, there's no way to possibly infer what any of this means. What any of the text, what any of the conversation, quote unquote,
I don't
means.
Know that it's impossible.
Well,
if you take it
there's
as
no
a whole,
context.
If you take it as a whole, all of the other drawings, and it all references women, airplanes, parties with women, young women.
Okay, but this would be a single passage. And I'm only playing devil's advocate. I think it's gross. It's not my thing. But this was a single passage that Donald Trump would have given to Ghislaine Maxwell, hypothetically, of course, allegedly, that she would have then put into a book. So it's not like he would have offered this entire piece. So it's just, it's very vague things. Again, not my thing, but like, we have certain things in common. Yes, we do, come to think of it. Like, I don't know what it really means. It does show that there may have been a relationship. It does show that there was a connection.
I think it's pretty clearly insinuating something.
But like, if this were to go to court, what is that? What would a jury be told to do? How would they be taken?
This is not criminal.
No, I understand. My point is, the White House at this point is just going to deny. They're going to deflect. They're going to push this to the side, which is not uncommon for a White House, for a communications team to just push some sort of negative press to the side. But it's not, the problem is it's now you have Trump allies that are co-signing this, that want the information. So you've created this division within your own party, and that is going to, in turn, create more of a difficult relationship with the White House and some of these officials.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, this oversight committee is getting information that we haven't seen. I mean, some of these documents being released from the DOJ, we have seen. Some of this picture we hadn't seen
right until
it was released by the oversight committee. And
it was reported by the Wall Street Journal.
I don't know that I saw that from the Wall Street Journal. I heard about it. Don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
But either way, this came from the estate that was subpoenaed, and it went to the Oversight Committee.
I always said, and I value the transparency, the honesty of politicians. We don't get it very often.
Mm-hmm.
There's been glimpses of Trump where he's been that way. You know, like going back to that initial debate with Hillary when he's like, "You're not going to change the tax code because I benefit from the tax code just like all your other rich friends benefit from the tax code and you're not going to change it." Like stuff like that, you're like, "What?" Like gasp. That's unbelievable that somebody would say that. And there's been, you know, even when he was talking about the tariffs, like this is going to hurt for a minute. Like we're going to work through it though. Like that's an honest thing to say, this is going to be painful, but we're going to work through it. We don't get that very often. I wish in this situation, Donald Trump would just go, yeah, this was a fly-by-night thing. I was asked to do it. We had talked a couple of times. And then you move on.
You know, I had my assistant put something together. I signed it.
Done. That's all you do.
We were friends, but I didn't know what he was
doing.
You think
Donald Trump is sitting at a typewriter in a computer in 2003 writing out this little dialogue between he and Jeffrey Epstein? Of course not.
But it shows that they were friends if he's included in a birthday book.
But I think to your point, all you would have to say is not own it, but there could just be a level of accountability going like, I didn't know this guy was a creep. Well, how did I know? Why would I possibly know that? They wanted me to put together a silly little thing between guys, so I did it in the way it's all you have to do. This story goes away.
I don't know if it goes away, I think that's a better argument than, I don't know what this is. This isn't my signature. I never did it. Because that seems far-fetched now.
But then again, what are the ramifications down the road?
Particular birthday book, nothing.
No, not this. I mean more of like the overarching political landscape.
I think that oversight committee is going to get more and more stuff. We'll see.
I think they're absolutely going to get more stuff. And I think they're under pressure. See, this is where, you know, if you are a political ideologue, you paint yourself into a corner. When you are so closely aligned with somebody because you either A, don't like the other person, or because you don't have the wherewithal to have an open mind about issues, you paint yourself into a corner. And would have many, particularly politicians on the Donald Trump side of things done, is they've talked about pedophilia and how bad this is and getting rid of these creeps and blah, 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 right?
Right. But in this case, there are 1,000 victims.
Bring that same heat then.
Right.
Nobody should be absolved of that because you may have cast a vote for members of their party.
Right. I don't care whose name's on this. Bring them all out.
Doesn't matter.
It does not matter. If you are involved in the trafficking of young women, you should be in trouble.
Correct. And it's crazy to me. It's crazy to me that they didn't make it a focus because it was obviously about immigration and crime and inflation, things like that during the election. But this wasn't not talked about. The Epstein stuff was talked about pretty frequently.
Oh, it was talked about a lot.
And then all of a sudden it's like, I don't know why this is a big deal anymore.
We could pull a million clips from President Trump, Cash Patel, Dan Bongino.
So it feels like you got to stick with this. This is something that you need to see through.
Break is the problem here and why people think something nefarious is happening or some important people are in those documents.
For sure. For sure. And how could you not? I mean, just look at, and not to conflate or compare, but like this whole Diddy trial, right? Again, this is a guy who holds a tremendous amount of influence, a tremendous amount of power in a different industry. But again, you have people coming over and wanting to party with this guy, coming to these parties and whatever. We shouldn't bury our heads in the sand that this stuff happens. And so what do you do about it?
Well, it clearly happened. Ghislaine Maxwell is in prison for this happening. There are victims, lots of victims, but we don't know anybody who was involved other than Epstein. And that's crazy.
No, and then this guy just goes and, hangs himself in prison. So again, you're void of answers, potentially.
But no, the Oversight Committee is going to find it.
I hope they do find as much as they can. Meanwhile, our car company is going to benefit from these rollback of emissions and standards in the automotive sector. We'll talk about that with Keaton Otten and Bloomberg coming up on JR Morning. 6:35. Well, when it comes to Donald Trump's push to cut EV standards or incentives, obviously rolling back emission standards, it's shaping the way how the automakers are approaching this shift in the industry. And it could be very beneficial from a sales perspective. It's the topic of our Mobility Makers, brought to you by Bridgestone. Getting people down the road matters, but getting generations down them, that's what really matters. Bridgestone, visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more. We bring in Keith Naughton to talk about this. Keith, good morning to you. How is this going to be a boon for automakers potentially?
Hi, good morning, Chris. Yeah, this really is Ford CEO Jim Farley calls a multi-billion dollar opportunity for the industry. What's happened is Trump is rolling back regulations on emissions and fuel economy, and he's zeroing out the penalties, the cash penalties that automakers had to pay for selling their big pickup trucks and their big SUVs that took them out of compliance with those regulations. And that's a big Ford alone said this will save them $1.5 billion this year.
Part of your story here, GM has spent $3.5 billion since 2022 purchasing so-called regulatory credits. What does that mean?
Yeah, so what happens is in order to stay in compliance with fuel economy and emission regulations, companies like GM and Ford and Stellantis that make a lot of gas-guzzling trucks and so forth have to buy those credits from companies who are in compliance. So those companies are Tesla, Rivian. Tesla, since 2020, has sold more than $10 billion in credits. That adds to Tesla's bottom line. Now Tesla doesn't get those anymore, and Ford and GM and Stellantis don't have those expenses anymore.
Wait, so Tesla complies, and then they sell credits and get money for that? How is that helping our emissions and environment?
It's that carrot and stick approach, Jamie. So the carrot was that $7,500 tax credit to consumers who bought electric vehicles, and that's going away on September 30th. The stick was you penalize automakers if they sell too many gas guzzlers, and you give credit to automakers who don't sell gas guzzlers like electric vehicle makers.
But it didn't stop the gas guzzling making. They just spent money.
Right. Well, okay. The thing is they make so much money on those pickup trucks and SUVs, it offsets these penalties that they had to pay for selling them.
Well, and how much money does like a company, for example, like Tesla, when they sell those credits, how much do they get?
Well, I mean, Tesla has already this year alone gotten $1 billion in those credits.
Right.
So a lot of money. It accounts for like 40% of Tesla's revenue. That goes away. So this move really hurts Elon Musk and Tesla.
So now with the EV tax credits going away, there's going to be less incentives for people to buy electric vehicles. We're entering kind of a new landscape here on the automotive front. How is what's happening going to dictate what these companies are doing in the near term here in Q3, Q4?
Sure, Chris, you're already seeing it. So that's a disincentive to build electric vehicles. Taking away these cash penalties, means automakers aren't really that motivated to build EVs. So you saw last week GM announcing that it's cutting production at two electric vehicle plants, the one that's going to make the Bolt in Kansas and the one that makes a couple of Cadillac EVs in Tennessee. Ford has shifted money that it had intended to spend on that three-row electric SUV it canceled a year ago. Well, that money is now going into internal combustion engine vehicles and hybrids. And also Ford has a plant up in Canada that it was going to build EVs in. Instead, it's going to build Super Duty pickup trucks.
So again, per your reporting, that Stellantis paid $190 million in those penalties over the last 2 years. Now, if they get that money back, that's good for their business.
It is good for their business, and that's another example of the shift, because Stellantis is bringing back the Hemi V8 engine. Well, that was the sort of engine that you'd have to pay penalties on in the past because it's a gas guzzler. Well, now, no problem. So they can bring this stuff back, and we can go back to the days of guzzling.
See, Jamie took my question, because it's good for them now, right? In the near term, their bottom line now. But if the industry is moving towards electrification, you see these car companies from out of the United States coming in, BYD, Chinese companies, et cetera, is that going to hurt the way that the current American manufacturers are dealing in this space?
Yeah, absolutely. It could turn them into laggards, right? They fall behind the global competition in electric vehicle technology because there's no longer a regulatory motivation to build them and to sell them. It absolutely presents a long-term risk. The Chinese have these inexpensive high-tech EVs that they're selling everywhere else in the world. They can't sell them here because of tariffs, but they're still out there. They're doing great in Europe, South America. So we fall behind as a nation in electric vehicles because there's no longer this penalty for not selling them.
So, but these companies are not abandoning electric vehicles, correct?
That's right.
And Ford has made a big investment recently.
They have. Ford, they're going to come out with this line of affordable EVs starting in 2027 with a mid-sized pickup truck that they're going to build down in Louisville, Kentucky. And they're spending $2 billion on that plant in Louisville to convert it from building gas-fueled Escapes right now and to making this line of EVs. That's great, but Jim Farley has also told Wall Street that, in his words, Ford is pretty massively reducing their EV spending because, they want to make more money off of internal combustion engine vehicles and hybrids.
So they'll stick with EVs, but at a slower rate.
That's right. They're going to spend a lot less on electric vehicles than they had been. Ford is building a new plant down in Tennessee, and then GM and Ford have been putting up electric battery plants, and they don't need that capacity anymore or as much of that capacity, so they're scaling back.
Keith, I want to ask you to get really political here. I know it's something that you're comfortable with. Is this like a direct dig at Elon, do you think, from the president? Do you think that there's a political aspect to this?
I mean, I don't think he's doing this to go after Elon. I think this is part of, you know, President Trump's promise during his campaign to eliminate what he called the EV mandate, if you remember that terminology. But this was where the schism began between these two. Elon Musk was very against the big, beautiful bill, which is where all of this is coming from. And that's when they started going to war on Twitter. So this is where the break happened, because Elon, for good reason, 10 billion reasons, didn't want this to happen.
Interesting. Keith, thank you for your time. As always, you're reporting great stuff. We'll talk again very soon.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. But it does disincentivize these companies from going down the EV road, as robust as they were.
Right. And if they want to be a global player, they're still going to look into EVs, research EVs, make EVs, but at a slower pace, because they don't have these markers they have to.
And as Keith mentioned, like Tesla, companies like Tesla, Rivian, these fully electric companies, they're just selling all their credits. That's where a huge chunk of their profits come from, because they don't make any gas guzzlers. They don't make any vehicles with gasoline.
This is certainly a hit to them. And anecdotally, there's a Rivian park next door to us. It looks really cool.
They are very cool.
I kind of want to ride.
Have you asked?
No, not yet.
All right, we'll take a break. More coming up on JR Morning, including what are House Republicans doing when it comes to a state leadership who are allegedly committing fraud. We'll talk about that coming up on JR Morning. Hey, make sure you're listening at 8:49 this morning. Give you an opportunity to win tickets to see the Trans-Siberian Orchestra live in concert December 27th at Little Caesars.
You're talking about Christmas?
2 days after Christmas, as a matter of fact. Have you ever seen TSO? Have you ever seen
them? I would love to.
They are awesome.
I've never seen them.
I'm
not allowed to win this.
No, you're not. But I'm a big metal guy. I love it. And you fuse these two worlds of like heavy metal and
Christmas
music. It is great. It's awesome.
Good to know.
It's awesome.
Let's talk about what's going on in Lansing here in the fall season. And that is, they're trying to figure out a budget. And we talked to Ann Bolin last week about some of their places that they found to cut. And they found it in ways that are sort of unfilled positions in the state. That's how it was described to us on this show last week. Beth LeBlanc and Craig Mauger have the story in the Detroit News that the GOP sees fraud in these vacant jobs, but others are saying it's a little more complicated than that. Let's bring in Beth to talk about it. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Do you like Trans-Siberian Orchestra? Just kidding. That's not the first question.
I'm going to plead the fifth.
Okay. Oh, there's a little flavor for you. All right, so let's talk about this budget. And you, in your reporting, you see that it's not as cut and dry as, here's a vacant position, we could save money.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the truth of the matter is that the state budget has had unused what they call full-time equivalents, or FTEs, for a long time. And it's over the years, it's been used by departments to kind of fill positions as they become vacant. As you can imagine, there are, you know, more than 40,000 state employees. There are always vacancies because of retirements or other employees who leave. And so some of these FTEs are used to fill those positions as people leave, or as they're trying to expand their ranks, as is the case with Michigan State Police or the Michigan Department of Corrections. There are like some extra FTEs. It does appear that, you know, there's a misalignment between what is actually needed for a department, or what a department can actually fill, and what has been appropriated to them. But the claims of fraud are getting a little bit in the weeds, because it first of all, the House Speaker could offer us no evidence of fraud at the end of the day when we asked him if there was any evidence of it. And second of all, I mean, these departments who have these openings, they actually submit quarterly and yearly reports to the legislature explaining why these jobs are vacant. In a lot of instances, it's that they're trying to fill them, or a work project got carried over and wasn't able to be started, or what have you. So they are keeping the legislature up to date pretty regularly on this. It is one of those things that's pretty complicated, and it's pretty in the weeds, and the average taxpayer probably isn't paying attention to it or But the departments have a good grasp on what those FTEs are, and a lot of times they're informing the legislature and budget heads about how this is working.
So this isn't an insignificant amount of money, these phantom state jobs that Ann Bolin or Matt Hall have talked about. $560 million in the state budget, and the Republicans have said they've kind of gone through the budget with a fine-tooth comb and took out a lot of the waste, fraud, and abuse. What would be the ramifications of that money not being allocated to these departments anymore? And then conversely to these departments, how impactful is that going to be?
Yeah, well, some of these full-time equivalents, I mean, they're clearly not using and not able to fill within a year's time. So like, I don't know that that will have an impact, but we did see in a few departments in particular that what the House budget is proposing would cut into existing jobs and get rid of folks who are actually there. In some instances, departments sent reports to the legislature saying, hey, let's say we have 1,500 people working in this area, and then the legislature cut into that 1,500 with these quote unquote FTE cuts that they did. So it would have some ramifications on existing jobs. If that's the intention of the House, they're the appropriators. So they can cut into those jobs, they can make layoffs, but to call them phantom state jobs or ghost employees, I think is overstating it a bit, because some of these people really are in positions within state government and are working. So that's probably the ramifications of it. The other thing is like what savings there will be from eliminating some of these FTEs, I think remains to be determined. They calculated that cost from what we can tell, based on like an average salary of each employee. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that doesn't average all the way out to FTEs. The other thing is that we have seen in some of the reports that these departments have put in that some of these full-time equivalents, which averages out to like, the hours worked in a year, some of those kind of tokens are being used for overtime for some employees. So it would limit what departments are able to do with overtime, which could have severe ramifications for a place like the Michigan Department of Corrections, where a lot of conservation officers are working overtime right now.
So put it in perspective, anecdotally, just the state police. They have some vacancies within their position, and now they're trying to fill them. If the budget passes as is from the House, they wouldn't be able to fill them?
You know, it's some of them they would. Okay, so the budget, I believe it accounts for two Michigan State Police Academy or Trooper Academies. So in that case, they would be able to add through those academies. But they also cut into a lot of full-time equivalent jobs. So, and like post operations. So it would decrease the number of, let's say, post positions that Michigan State Police is authorized to use, but then it also adds troopers from a trooper school. So it's not very clear like how that would work or where those troopers would go, which post they'd be assigned to if a post isn't authorized for the full amount of troopers. So that's where it gets pretty complicated. And mm-hmm. and we did talk to budget experts where they said, look, there is misalignment between what is appropriated to these departments and how many FTEs they have, and that probably should be addressed. But the extent to which it is addressed in the House budget definitely cuts into existing positions and real employees. There's no proof that we've seen so far that these FTE positions are being misused or misallocated.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like this is something that the Senate's going to keep in place.
I do think it's very complicated. So thank goodness there's some journalists asking questions like Beth LeBlanc. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, so it's confusing, these line items.
It's a little weedy.
But it's just not as easy as these are vacant, we're wasting money on that, let's cut it.
And the Republicans are essentially saying, look, here's, we have money allocated, and then you're not filling the positions. So you just are holding the money. So you don't need to hold the money if you're not going to fill the positions.
That's the simplistic way of saying it.
But
these
on the
FTEs
other side, correct,
are people that are still working doing the job.
Absolutely. And Republicans have said they take their best guess. They don't have all the best information.
Okay, we got to the bottom of that.
Yeah.
7 o'clock hour next.
Good to have you this morning. I was driving home yesterday, Jamie, after the show, and I experienced something that I never experienced before. I saw a crash on the Lodge happen right in front of me, and it was not an insignificant crash. It was very scary.
Yeah, I mean, those are high speeds on the Lodge.
High speed. They were not going 55 or whatever the speed limit on the Lodge is. It was much faster, and this guy rear-ended this person in front of me, and it was jarring. And it's, look, we always say, like, you don't speed, you know, use your turn signal, don't pass on the right, all those things. But until you see that happen, like, in real life, in real time, it's very scary.
Are the people okay?
Last I knew, yes.
Okay.
Last I knew, yes. I'd called 911, I filed the report and the whole deal. But it was very scary. Very scary.
Are you carefully driving, a more careful driver now after seeing that?
I can tell you it was funny because I was on the phone with my wife and she's like, you know, I had some things to say that I can't say here.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like freaking out, what's wrong? And I'm like, I got to go. I'll call you back because I needed to call 911. I wanted to get it in right away. And so... Yeah, for like the immediate afterwards, I was fine. And then the more I was driving around, because I had some errands to run after the show, I was like, it started to build up a little bit. Where I was just much more like hesitant, which is not really how you want to drive. You don't want to be passive necessarily. But it was very scary. Very scary.
Well, I'm glad you're okay.
Yeah. Well, I hope that everybody else is.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that was in this accident, but scary stuff.
I like that you're here.
Yes, it is nice to be here. Meanwhile, the situation with these ICE agents in places like Illinois, in places like L.A., all of this continues to roll. And now Donald Trump is expanding some of these operations in Illinois, and we don't really know what that means yet.
Did you see the Truth Social post over the weekend where it's got like, I mean, there's a lot of AI generated posts coming out recently, like the Cracker Barrel. Yes. But I'm talking about the one that looked like an assault on the American on an American city. Department of War, like, we're coming for you, Chicago, there were helicopters.
Yes.
That's wild.
It is wild.
And it looked like the city was burning.
Yes, it is wild.
Chicago apocalypse or something was on
that
one.
Because that's just not, I mean, that's not the reality.
Crazy.
Yeah.
That's some crazy tweeting there. Does that translate to, you know, federal agents going into Chicago? We don't know that yet. But it was easier in D.C. because he has purview over that city. Not so much in Chicago. And some folks that are supporters of President Trump are coming out and saying, you can't do this. One of them is Megyn Kelly.
It very clearly is not constitutionally permissible. He cannot do it. I really hope he doesn't do it because I don't want a world in which I'm siding with Governor Pritzker over President Trump. But I will if he does it because he can't do it legally. However, I think that's what he's saying, Batya, that he's realized that and that he's going to send the help to cities and states that want it. And what a great way of shaming the Governor Pritzkers of the world.
Yeah, she's right.
You can't do it.
She's right.
You're not supposed to do it.
And not only is she right, take it a step further. Because what Donald Trump said, and it was almost like a byline after a breath, when he was like, I'm going to send them to Chicago. We're going to Chicago next, as long as they ask me to do it. Like, it's like he did qualify it. Like, I need them to ask. And you have people on the left going, well, he just wants Pritzker to kiss the ring. He wants him to bend the knee and beg for you to come in and save the city, which obviously is not going to happen. But he knows that he can't just send them in, that this doesn't qualify as some immediate danger. And so
emergency.
And so he knows that that's the case.
I was listening to reporting from D.C. yesterday. Some folks who witness crime on their street, afraid to go out, happy federal agents are there because it's had a deterrent for their street. Another person on this reporting show was talking about how they're one of those community activists where they're trying to prevent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal agents aren't exactly preventing like the crime that he sees. So he did not want it.
Right.
So it's like very divided, even in a place where there's a lot of crime.
Yeah. And again, it's, I can make the argument it's good that they're there. It's good that they're deterring crime. And then you can make the argument that it's temporary. What happens when they're eventually gone? What happens to those crime numbers? They're going to go back up, hypothetically.
Right.
Hypothetically. That's the counter to that. But then on the other side of all of this is, okay, I think Donald Trump is almost using this particular issue, sending troops into Chicago, sending troops into these states where there is a good amount of crime. I think he's trying to make it into a political issue because he's going to put Pritzker on records saying that, no, crime is fine. I don't want you to come in here and save the day. And basically saying that we're okay with status quo.
I think politics absolutely is involved here because now it's all of a sudden this big focus on crime when there was a lot of negativity around the big, beautiful bill, its effects, the Epstein stuff, and now we're talking crime.
Yeah. And I think Megyn Kelly is right. And good on Megyn Kelly a little bit for saying that, right? You need to have people that are, you're not just a blind loyalist. You're not just somebody that follows everything that the president does, that there is some critical thinking out there.
Yeah, you have to believe in what you believe in and put it out there regardless of who you support.
7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial, tech, and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. People are searching for supplemental income these days, and as a result, side hustles, part-time side jobs or entrepreneurial endeavors, also known as side gigs, are not only in vogue, for many, they are a necessity. According to data just released from Payments Intelligence, now 2 in 5 Americans are now side hustlers, actively earning money outside their primary job, whether through contract work, reselling clothes and furniture, milking their credit cards for rewards, rideshare driving such as Uber or Lyft, selling handmade goods or renting out their properties are just some examples of how people are making money on the side these days. Those joining Side Hustle Nation, most these days, people whose monthly paychecks come in the door and immediately go right back out as soon as the bills are paid. Almost 7 in 10, 69% to be exact, of all U.S. consumers already live paycheck to paycheck as of last month. The current economic clouds have prompted 3 in 4 of those struggling consumers to either begin taking on side work or increasing their frequency of already doing so. And higher earners have jumped on board as well. Surprisingly, 3 in 4 hustlers hold a full-time or part-time job that allows them to live comfortably, as they say, meeting the ability to pay all their bills. More than 1 in 4 consumers making more than $100,000 a year started side work due to general economic conditions. Whether those extra dollars are used to build up emergency funds, that, by the way, the number one reason, pay down debt, bankroll a vacation or bathroom remodel, invest in stocks, or save for retirement, side hustling is indeed in vogue. Of course, we're all hustling these days in one way or the other, and now this new data makes clear just how significant the trend of hustling on the side is these days. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business, and that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So Education Secretary Linda McMahon was in town yesterday. She visited a number of different schools, the Pembroke Academy. She visited Renaissance High School in Detroit and Washington Parks Academy in Redford. She also visited Hillsdale College as part of this trip. She did talk a lot about colleges and what college should be. Quote, college should be a trial by fire that inspires students to struggle and strive. And this should begin in the admissions office, where the requirements should be rigorous, selective, and completely merit-based. Classes should be challenging and make no apologies or accommodations. And this is all part of this idea of downsizing what the federal oversight of education is and passing more of that down to the state level. Congressman Tim Walberg was with the secretary yesterday and joins us to talk about her trip. Congressman, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be with you.
What was it? What does it mean to have Linda McMahon in town talking about education here in the state?
Well, it's exciting. Michigan is a place that was known for its educational prowess for many, many years. As we talked yesterday, brought my vice chairman of the Education and Workforce Committee that I chair with me, Burgess Owens from Utah, as we drove from the Hillsdale campus, both Hillsdale College and Hillsdale Academy, the classical school we toured. I talked about the arsenal of democracy and what education meant to this state as we did what we needed to do to support the war effort and then beyond with the auto industry and everything that really pushed America forward. And it's sad to see the NAEP scores, the most recent ones that came out just last night, are discouraging. We have to turn things around. And I have the education secretary there, whose quote you just read really espouses what I believe and what I think will make education great, and that starts by pushing it back to the closest to the student, and that's the teacher, parent, and the student themselves to get things done. And yesterday was exciting. I was only able to be with her before we headed back to D.C. At Pembroke and at Hillsdale. But we got an example of what can be done. And I believe what can be done in every school district and needs to be done in every school district across Michigan, across this country. Mm. And that's not just charter schools. That's not just classical schools. That's not just public schools. But it's a whole gamut of things that meet the needs of the student.
You mentioned that American high school senior scores on major math and reading tests fell to their lowest levels on record, according to the U.S. Department of Education here. So how do we make it better? How, putting it back to the states, how does that make it better? And is there a plan to do this state by state since this is a 50-state tour?
Well, there is a plan to do it state by state, Jamie. I appreciate that question. But I believe we need to go back to the basics. We've spent over $1 trillion since the founding of the Department of Education, which is only back to 1980. And before that, we were the arsenal of democracy. We were the hotbed of innovation in the world. The space industry came, but before that, the agricultural, industrial revolution, all of that took place with common sense approaches. Things like phonics, we watch kids doing various phonics approaches to learning not only how to read and sound out letters, but also to print and then ultimately do cursive and things like that. Just the basics that are there. And really putting a partnership in place. Pembroke was interesting. They have a partnership marriage at the beginning of each year. And they had on display the wedding cake that had the five, I believe it was the five principals that are involved in that school, the heritage system. And they have the parents state vows with the teachers who will state vows, and almost a marriage, a partnership saying, this is what we commit to. We will not divorce, but we will work together to bring about what's necessary for the student. You know, those type of concepts, Jamie, worked in years gone by where parents and teachers were involved together, and the local community had those ideas for what worked best for the kids, and merit was encouraged. Discipline is put in the classroom. Teachers are given the opportunity to teach because there was a support base. And so that's what we're talking about. It's not just a one-size-fits-all. The learning capabilities, I think, will be expanded by giving the laboratories of success in education, each individual state, the opportunity to show what can be done. And Michigan could do that. We could get back to leading the way. And Indiana and Illinois and Ohio could be watching what we're doing. And then the reverse, we watching what they do that brings about success. And that doesn't involve a monolithic entity called the U.S. Department of Education. It works better at the local level.
So then where are we at on this process? This is something that would require congressional approval. Is there an appetite for that?
Well, we've started it. First time in history, we have a federal tuition tax credit that is available. It's minimal at this point, but we at least have it in law. We put it in place in the Working Families Tax Cut Bill, the ECCA, Educational Choice Act. It gives each state, this is not a mandate, but it gives each state, including Michigan, the opportunity through their legislature and their governor to make a decision whether they will allow this federal tax cut, tax credit to be used by their constituents, their residents, in Michigan. I know that Indiana and Ohio are already going to use that, give people the opportunity to put funds with a federal tax credit towards scholarshiping people across a spectrum, which would include public charter schools as well. Hmm. And I think that will start the ball rolling, and people will see it works. It doesn't hurt the traditional public schools. In fact, I think the competition, the commitment to education will encourage all of our public schools to step up as well. They can do it. They have the resources. They have the teachers. I think there are a lot of teachers just longing for the opportunity to stand or sit in front of those kids and have a huge, unabated opportunity to educate. And I think parents want to see that as well.
Where do you stand on this cell phone ban that some states are implementing? Because some are saying these scores here for 12th graders are related to screen time and phones.
You know, that should be a local issue. But if I were making a decision, if I were voting on that at a school board meeting, I would vote for it. I'm old enough to remember that if we were chewing gum in the classroom,
that
we
was
had
a
problems.
Bad no-no. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember trying to listen to the World Series on my transistor radio, tucked away and hidden in such a way that I could listen until I got caught. The classroom is for education, and you know, when some parents say, "Well, I want it for security to know where my kid is, be able to communicate." You can do that by calling the office. The classroom is a place for education, and anything that takes away the attention of the students, and it was beautiful to watch a little kindergartens yesterday being carefully brought through how to draw a C and do it right and hold their pencils right and understand the science of reading.
Sure.
Through phonetics. That doesn't take place when the student
right.
has a cell phone
right.
in front of them.
Well, Congressman, I think you taught us that you were able to listen to the Tigers World Series and still be a congressman. See how that turned out for you?
Some distractions, okay.
Yeah. Congressman Tim Walberg, always appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
have
of course. You got it. You do the same. We'll take a break. More coming up on JR Morning.
For those people who want to start up a business, a startup, if you will, we want ideas to happen. We want to foster those ideas and help people along, because who knows if it's not the next latest, greatest thing.
Certainly.
So there's a pitch competition exclusively for Michigan-based startups, and we want to talk about it with Peter Martin, Director of Portfolio Management at the MSU Research Foundation. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. How you doing?
We are good. So we want smart people to do smart things. This is a step in the right direction. How did this come about?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the Research Foundation itself has been around for like 50 years supporting technology coming out of the university. But more recently, we've become one of the most active investors in not just Michigan, but the entire Midwest. And so there's been a lot of focus at the foundation on supporting high growth startups all across the state of Michigan. And we've been in conversations, we saw as part of the Michigan Innovation Fund that was passed earlier this year, we've been in conversations with lots of folks. We have lots of ecosystem partners around the state around this opportunity to put on a pitch competition to support Michigan startups. It's the right time. The startups in Michigan have raised more money than any other state in the Midwest as of 2024. It's really cool. And so now's the right time to be putting on a really big pitch competition to support this state's founders, because the founders here are good enough. I like to say, like Jared Goff is good enough for Detroit, founders in Michigan are good enough for our state.
What are some of the sectors that are being spotlighted in this competition?
Yeah, there are. So I spent most of my adult career outside of the state of Michigan, and anybody that you talk to only knows automotive. Mm-hmm. And we're the best state in the country, maybe the best location in the world for automotive. But this pitch competition is spotlighting the fact that Michiganders are phenomenal in all of these different industries. So we've got healthcare that we're spotlighting in Grand Rapids. We have outdoor innovation and clean tech in Traverse City. In Detroit, we're talking about mobility, but it's the future of mobility, right? So drones and aerospace and everything like that in mobility, but also defense and also advanced manufacturing in Detroit. Mm. and in Ann Arbor, we'll be spotlighting software and AI. So there's all sorts of different industries where Michigan has competitive advantages that we get to highlight as part of this pitch competition.
$4 million pitch competition. It's called Pitch Me, but it's spelled Pitch MI, utilizing our state initials there. How do you get involved?
Yeah, you can go to PitchMe, so PitchMi.org, to learn more about the pitch competition, to apply for the pitch competitions. Applications are open until Sunday, September 14th. So apply now. If you have a startup or if you're building a startup, go to PitchMe.org and apply. And I would say one more thing here. We're really fortunate to be working with partners all across the state. And we have, again, all of these cities, Grand Rapids, Traverse City, Ann Arbor, Detroit. Detroit in particular, we've got Invest Detroit Ventures is coming on board to help. Tech Town is coming on board to help. Mm-hmm. Assembly Ventures is this prize. We have four pitch competitions that are coming up in just about 3 weeks' time. The winner of each of these pitch competitions is going to receive a $250,000 investment. In Detroit, we're sharing that prize with Assembly Ventures. So it's not just us. I think we will be a great investor to have on board these companies. But Assembly Ventures is also coming in with us in Detroit. So we're really excited about that.
Yeah, this is not an insignificant amount of money. You're talking about eight startups win $250,000. And then they're going to advance to win an additional or with a chance to win an additional $1 million. What are some of the most innovative things you've seen come out of this competition?
Yeah, well, this pitch competition is relatively new. So we did it last year, the state of Michigan put on Pitch Me with a $100,000 prize. If I'm correct, I believe Civilized Cycles won that pitch competition. This one, we're expanding it. So we have four regional pitch competitions and then this championship. The prize is going to be much, much bigger. But you had, more recently, SkySpecs won the kind of the previous iteration of this pitch competition, went on to raise tens of millions of dollars and build a highly valuable company. That's the possibility.
Right.
What we're looking for are companies that can be worth hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in valuation, hire many thousands of people, and have significant impact all across Michigan. And that really is, like, when we shine the spotlight on Michigan, what we've seen as the MSU Research Foundation, because we have these hundreds of portfolio companies, we've become incredibly confident in the Michigan founder, because the folks here, our culture is kind of like, we are full of people that just build things and make things. And so it's easy to get behind a Michigan founder. We know that they are going to build something great. And if we can give them the capital and shine a bit of a spotlight on them so that more people can learn about them and see what they're doing, we're really confident that that's going to provide orders of magnitude returns for their company, for the state of Michigan, for us as investors. I think we're all going to win because of this.
How are you doing on getting the word out? Are pretty cool companies signing up?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had many companies have signed up already, and many more will sign up. That usually, with pitch competitions, usually a lot more in the last couple of days. But we are, we're fortunate to have lots of ecosystem partners around the state of Michigan that are helping to push this to their networks, to their portfolio companies, to founders that we don't know. I think that's one of the things I'm most excited about is seeing who applies for this pitch competition that we haven't met before. Because even if they get selected, we can still help them. Our organization can still help them. We've got folks all over the state. We have people in Grand Rapids and Detroit and, of course, East Lansing, but also Traverse City, also in the Upper Peninsula. And if we can't support them, the state can. Smart zones across the state can. And we're really happy to be able to put more resources behind all founders in Michigan. Really excited to see who applies for this thing.
So what's the window here? How long can people apply? Where can they apply?
So pitchme.org to learn more and apply. Go to pitchme.org, and you can apply until September 14th, 11:59 p.m. So this Sunday, please get your applications in. It won't be extended.
Very cool idea. Peter Martin, Director of Portfolio Management at MSU Research Foundation. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you very much.
Cool.
It's cool. Yeah, and really we need, and Michigan has become more of a hub. Thankfully, the Michigan State University Research Foundation is getting involved in this. But this idea of Michigan becoming a hotbed for ingenuity, innovation, is really important. And we need to be pushing the envelope. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, we have, really smart people out there that are trying to do that.
Yeah. And for this pitch competitions, I think it's like more idea phase than the companies I saw over at NewLab, who are now testing prototypes and things like that. But having all of these ideas out there is so important.
Yeah, it's huge. And like, even like, I like whatever you think of Elon, whatever. But like this, this, you know, with Starlink and SpaceX and the Neuralink that he's got, I mean, these are all pushing the boundary of what
we're capable of. Well, it starts with an idea, doesn't it?
And this is where it starts, exactly.
And getting a little push here, winning $250,000.
That's a big push.
It's big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really
cool. Good luck to everyone. And what do you say, 11:59?
11:59 Sunday. Got to get it in.
All right, coming up on JR Morning, we're going to talk about some cool tickets we have to share, plus reliable transportation. Everyone needs it. Is it in jeopardy? We'll talk about that at 7:49.
So, you know, they're talking about the budget in Lansing.
What?
Some of these
they are
potential cuts that could be on the
table. About it.
Well, and the difference between where the Republicans are at and where the Senate's at, or where the Democrats are at, is like $6 billion.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
It's a big difference.
And one of the things that they're obviously talking about are the road plans and transit funding and all of these things. And, you know, in a lot of communities, the public bus system, transit systems are very important. It's a major way for people to get around with that reliable transportation. But is that in danger? Is some of that funding, could that possibly be going away? Well, let's talk with John Dolmes, the executive director of the Michigan Transit Association. John, it's good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, tell us a little bit about the funding that you are operating on now. Is it enough? And what happens if some of that goes away?
Yeah, thanks. You know, our local transit agencies all across Michigan, from urban Metro Detroit to rural northern Lower Peninsula Michigan, are funded with federal, state, and local dollars. And in many cases, there's local millages that voters have approved to help support that. But in the case of the state funding, that's what's really a concern, because it has not kept up with the costs. And just like our roads that we see crumbling and bridges in need of replacement, our public transit system is about to crumble a little bit too because of that state funding.
So there are going to be transit leaders in Lansing today talking with folks in the legislature and saying what? That we do need these funds?
Absolutely. We are here to say that we need a solution. We need a funding increase for transit. And thankfully, the road funding discussion is a great way to do that, because traditionally, Michigan has funded things like local transit, as well as freight rail, passenger rail, bike paths, and other things from the same sources that fund our roads and bridges. And so we're hopeful that leaders can come together on a package that will provide a long-term funding boost, not only to make our roads safer, but also to provide buses so that everyone can get where they need to go.
What's the proposed cuts right now? What would those mean to you? How would the service be interrupted or altered some way?
Yeah, so what that looks like in transit is really just the availability to get that ride where you need to go. And it may mean that limited hours or frequency of service. So instead of the bus coming every half an hour, or ideally more frequent, that bus might come only once an hour, which is really of limited use for people. And in rural counties, that might mean the bus stops running at 5 p.m. on a Friday without even any service on Saturday or Sunday, which is already the case in many parts of Michigan. But that's the first thing to get cut is the expense of operating vehicles on the nights and weekends. We know people want to get where they need to go, whether it's to work or to the airport or to a medical appointment and after school activities. All those things are at risk.
What is the data for the usage of public transit in the counties here in Michigan?
Yeah, so statewide, Michigan had about 50 million rides last year. So that's about 125,000 rides every day. And in many rural communities, those are longer distance trips. They're going to be riding on a shuttle 30 minutes to go to a doctor's appointment in the center of the county. In Metro Detroit, those are fixed route services like SMART and DDOT, the People Mover and the Q Line. So those rides are going to be shorter. They can stop at a fixed place at a bus stop and get on and off. And it really is tens of thousands of Michiganders that are riding every day. And those are the ones that most likely don't own a car. You've got someone in your family that may not be able to drive or able to afford that extra vehicle and still be able to get to work.
I imagine you probably have to get a bit creative when it comes to maintaining the service too.
Absolutely. There are some creative solutions out there. We've seen transit systems are partnering with hospitals and colleges and universities to get those populations, whether it be to healthcare or to education. The People Mover, for example, has a corporate sponsor, and actually riders can ride for free. But we know that transit costs a lot of money, and just like everything else in our lives has gone up, the cost of fuel, tires, drivers to get them safely where they need to go, that has gone up every year. And so we need the state funding to keep up the same way.
What is the timeline here? I know you're going to talk to lawmakers today. I guess it's all tied to when they come up with the final budget.
We're waiting like everyone else, and we're here in Lansing to talk to legislators about a funding solution by October 1st. But if that doesn't happen, we're going to experience a pretty significant cut for next year's operating budgets for transits. Many will have to make cuts pretty soon. Some already have, and others are using savings that they've put away, some from COVID relief dollars or surpluses. But it's going to be a year or two before pretty much across the state we're going to see that service really cut back. And that's going to make it hard for many people to get to work, for employers to get their customers and employees there.
John, we've talked a little bit about the uncertainty that the schools face because their budget is unknown. Is that the same for you guys, the unknown of how much you'll be allocated, how much money you'll be able to spend? Does that impact your service?
To some extent, yes. Right now, transit agencies are actually preparing for a worst-case scenario. So they are planning their budgets with the base amount of funding, which is about a 10% cut already from last year. Meanwhile, those expenses have gone up. So we're hopeful for a solution that will get us up back to at least where we are in the current year. Like I said, it's not sustainable to maintain it at this level. And the state funding really should be about double of what it is. If you go back only about 15 to 20 years, the state funded almost half of what local transit's required to operate. And today that number is closer to about 25 or 30%.
Mm. John Dalmez, the executive director of the Michigan Transit Association. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. Keep us up to date on how those conversations go.
Will do. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you got it. But the road funding continues to be a major part of these conversations. And then the transit part. You know, I mean, we are in a locale geographically where a lot of people drive, but not everybody has that ability.
Right.
And so the transit systems being able to get people where they need to go, to their doctor's appointments, to wherever, work, really important that those services continue to operate.
100%. Yeah. And so we'll see what happens with the budget. A couple seconds here at the end of this segment. Did you see who Sharon Moore named as the acting head coach for the next
game? I did. Biff Poggi.
Great name.
Yeah. His son Henry played at Michigan a number of years ago, probably 10 years ago now. He was a high school coach, I believe, in like the greater Baltimore area. And he became very close with Jim Harbaugh, coached under Jim Harbaugh on that first staff. And now he's coming in to sit in for Sharon Moore. Very interesting choice.
Yeah, just announced yesterday that he will be the acting head coach as Moore was suspended 3 games when it's all related to that Connor Stallion stuff. 1 game in 2026, 2 games here this season.
He did coach the 49ers, though. He was the head coach of the 49ers for a couple of years in Charlotte, the Charlotte 49ers in college football.
I see what you did.
See what I did there?
I see what you did.
Not in San Francisco.
I want to, when we get into this 8 o'clock hour here, I want to talk about a former Wolverine and his performance last night, too.
Love it. Let's do it. Coming up next here on JR Mornings, 8 o'clock hour. Don't go anywhere. 8:05, good to have you this Tuesday morning. By the way, we've got tickets for the Trans-Siberian Orchestra concert coming up December 27th at Little Caesar coming up. It's coming December 27th, not so fast. And we'll give you an opportunity to win those tickets coming up at 8:49, so keep listening. We've now seen all NFC North teams in action. Last night we saw it.
Are you concerned?
I'm a little concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned. Minnesota defeated Chicago last night.
Why did they defeat them? Because of 3 touchdowns by J.J. McCarthy.
J.J. McCarthy.
In the fourth quarter. He's like the first guy in his first year to do that in the fourth quarter.
Takes a lot of composure to do, certainly. I think we should be a little concerned. And I still think the Bears aren't very good. And the creativity of Ben Johnson hasn't really shown up yet. But that's because they're not at that point yet. Like, Ben Johnson can't roll out the red carpet on his playbook quite yet. They're just not there.
J.J. McCarthy did throw a pick six.
He did.
And so early on, I'm like, oh, not ready. But then that fourth quarter was amazing. He hasn't lost a regular season game as a starter since October 26, 2019. A 72-36 Nazareth Academy setback to Bennett Academy. That was 2,144 days ago.
Yes.
That guy is a winner.
It's crazy. I mean, how is that possible? Now, that's not going to happen. Eventually, Minnesota will lose a game here. But the fact that you go all the way through high school, all the way through college at a major level, and then get to the NFL and haven't lost a regular season game is just, it's unthinkable.
Yeah.
It's unthinkable.
Yeah, so he looks to be good. The Bears looked pretty good because they were winning that game by double digits. The Packers look good.
Meanwhile, you know, there's a lot of talk over redistricting, a lot of talk over what's happening in places like Texas, what's happening in places like California. Well, there's also these special elections that are popping up that happen. The Cook Political Report, the nonpartisan Cook Political Report, rates one particular race in particular in Virginia. That is filling the seat of Jerry Connolly, who passed away, as a solidly D seat, meaning that Democrats are going to potentially cut into the Republicans' lead. So all this talk about redrawing these maps could be pretty consequential, because Republicans could be losing another seat in the House.
And a lot of Republicans are trying to be governors. They're going to go on those campaign trails, and so yeah, the numbers.
John James here in the state of Michigan. There was some.
We haven't talked to John James in a while.
We have not.
He just tweeted out that he was at Fabiano Brothers, you know, in Bay City area, looking at all the stuff they're doing. Let's get him on the show.
He remember there was some discussions on some other lawmakers here in the state about whether they were going to run for governor, whether they were going to run for Senate here in the state of Michigan. Bill Huizenga being one of them. And they've backed off a lot of that, obviously, especially now. But the worry was that they were losing seats. And that's not in a position that certainly Mike Johnson wants to be in.
No. We talked about President Donald Trump's push to cut federal sales incentives, roll back emissions, and all that means multimillion dollars for the big three. And some losses for companies like Tesla and Rivian because they're not selling those credits.
Yep.
Or won't be anymore.
Right.
Well, here's news out of the Detroit News that just came out now that Rivian has laid off 200 employees as the electric vehicle maker prepares for those fewer incentives. And we were talking to Keith Naughton about it, like, how's that going to impact these companies that are all electric? Well, here you go. It's 200 employees. A spokesman at the company said the layoffs are equivalent to about 1.5% of its total staff of nearly 15,000. Wall Street Journal first to report this.
Yeah, and again, it's not real consequential yet, but this is not, I mean, Rivian is not General Motors or Ford. They don't have that kind of staffing. So you're talking about, in relation, a pretty substantial portion of their workforce.
Yeah.
Because they're gearing up that they're going to take a hit. It's very interesting. Lyme disease is spiking in Michigan. Have you seen this?
Yes.
Parents live in like the Northville Novi area. They get deer in their yard all the time. And I don't want to be like a paranoid person or anything like that, but the kids are over there a lot. They play in the yard a lot. Like yesterday, 2 days ago, there were four deer in their yard at one time. Four. And they were just walking around, eating the grass, whatever. But like a part of me is like, are there ticks? Are there, you know, these Lyme ticks, whatever? I can't help it because we've seen these numbers spike and it's become really problematic for people. Was it Justin Timberlake came out and said he had Lyme disease? Is that true? Beth Ann, is that true? Justin Timberlake?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. So, I mean, crazy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, according to the Detroit News, their numbers are spiking. I don't know anyone who's gotten Lyme disease, but it's something to keep an eye on.
Of Michigan's 83 counties, health departments in 26 said that their surveillance of ticks this year have gone up in tick dragging, which helps them find new ticks in these areas. Again, they do a lot of tick monitoring more towards the southern part of the state because that's where more people are. So they're just watching that. They know, they obviously have a better idea of what goes on in northern Michigan, but they just want to keep track of what's what that, how those numbers are fluctuating down south.
This picture, this thing that was in the Epstein birthday book is all over the place now. President Caroline Leavitt saying, we don't know anything about it. It's not ours. We don't, we, it wasn't us. Which I, it's just too weird. And this all came from the House Oversight Committee subpoena. So, you know, giving a, getting a subpoena for the Epstein estate. And they handed over this birthday book, which has multiple sort of pages of pictures that aren't great.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, the New York Times did a piece. So one of the criticisms was from one of the comms people in the White House, Taylor Budowich. He came out and said, time for News Corp to open the checkbook defamation lawsuit, basically coming. Because they don't believe that the signature on this particular picture matches Donald Trump's. Well, what the New York Times did is, you know, the pictures that were given as an example from the White House were current signatures.
Mm-hmm.
What the New York Times did.
His current signature is Donald Trump, Donald J. Trump.
Correct.
When he signs things to personal friends, it's just Donald.
Donald. And even now, the Donald is a little different now. But what they did is they went back and looked at signatures from the early
1990s,
early 2000s and late 1990s. And they're all pretty very, I mean, they're very similar. It's this little trail off at the end of the D.
So deep dive of this signature.
Deep dive of the signature. So maybe the defamation lawsuit.
Why can't you just be like, yeah, I wrote a little card to my friends.
That's my,
that doesn't prove anything.
That's my thing is it not only, I mean, it doesn't prove anything. And you could say, I didn't know what he was up to. It was something I was asked to do it, so I did it. And then you move on. This maybe goes away, but it's become a bigger issue. And as a result, you've got more lawmakers on your side that have sided with others that are saying we need to make sure that this information gets out.
This will not go away. The Oversight Committee is on it.
The man charged in an assassination attempt on former candidate Donald Trump's life is heading to trial. We'll talk about it coming up on JR Morning. Well, the man accused of trying to assassinate Donald Trump down in Florida is ready to stand trial. That will begin on Monday. And he issued even an apology to potential jurors yesterday saying, sorry for bringing you all in here. Thank you for being here. He told the group of 60 jurors. This is in front of Judge Eileen Cannon. Prosecutors and Ryan Routh were introduced to the panel. So this process is just getting underway, and it's certainly going to be a contentious one. Let's bring in Todd Flood, the managing partner at Flood Law, to talk about it. Todd, good morning to you, my friend.
Good morning, my friend. How are you?
We're well. This is going to be a wild one, I imagine. What can we expect out of this?
This is a slow plea, as we would call it in the defense world. You know, ultimately, it's going to end up in a conviction. You know, you represent yourself. You have a fool for a client. So in this particular case, you know, the guardrails have to be put up because the judge needs to make sure that there's no reversible error. You only want to try this case once. But there's just overwhelming evidence. And, you know, the prosecution has some 33 different books of exhibits, you know, along with the gun and the testimony. It's just really, again, going to take 2 weeks to 3 weeks of just having the conviction ultimately come through. And he's already making a mockery of the courtroom. He's already, you know, putting in a motion I just read about I challenge President Trump to a beatdown, or I challenge him to a golf match. If I win, you know, I get his job. If he wins, I'll take the death penalty. So, you know, I mean, the other thing here is you got to put the, as I said, the guardrails. They have two attorneys sitting up there for him in the background, even though he's representing himself, just to help make sure that there's nothing of constitutional error put in place.
How do you keep this from becoming a spectacle? I mean, if he's representing himself and he's trying to ask the jury questions about a turtle, how do we get through this?
The judge is going to put a tight leash on him and cut him off. There's, you know, when you get what we call voir dire, that's when you impanel a jury, Jamie, and you have this big veneer of whatever, 100 potential jurors in the veneer, and you're starting to ask, you know, questions of the potential jurors. Judges will oftentimes, in cases like this, take away your questions, or you questioning jurors, and will do the voir dire herself. In doing that, you know, she wants to make sure that there's a fair and impartial jury. She wants to make sure that no one's made up their mind, that they can listen to the evidence and follow the law that the judge gives. So that's the overall, well, you know, overall basic rule and tenet of making sure you get a fair and impartial jury. And judges in this case, I can see this judge in particular, taking away lawyers and Ruth or Ralph, however you pronounce his name, from asking questions.
The judge had interjected, none of the questions on your list have any bearing whatsoever. They were off base, sir, and have no relevance in jury selection. He says, I have more questions. If you don't like the ones I submitted, they're supposed to be getting to the jurors. Is that not what we're doing here? So, right, to Jamie's point, a bit of a spectacle. Is it going to be difficult to find a jury in this case, do you think?
No. I think, you know, I think jurors, for the most part, can set aside their biases and prejudice. You know, we all have them when you walk into a courtroom, and I can point them out. I do all the time with prospective jurors. But the question is, can you set that aside and can you follow the law? Can you follow the, you know, your bias and your prejudice aside and follow what the judge says the law is and what base your decision on the evidence that comes into the courtroom? You know, how many times have we had high profile cases? I was involved in the Kwame Kilpatrick case or the Bobby Ferguson trial or you name it, in multiple big trials. And you'd have to be living under a rock within Wayne County or the state of Michigan or the Midwest not to know about those cases. But ultimately, we got a fair and impartial trial. You have to attempt to do that. And I think that that will happen here.
What do you think the timeline is for a case like this? I mean, it's high profile, but it seems like the evidence is fairly obvious.
Yeah. So the clumsiness of this trial is going to be the biggest problem. The clumsiness of not being able to have a competent attorney represent the defendant and the defendant trying to make it a spectacle. I think realistically, this is a 2-week trial. If you just had competent attorneys going at it, and unfortunately, because you have to make sure that there's no, you know, major mistakes, that it gets reversed on appeal, unfortunately, this is probably going to take longer than 2 weeks. It shouldn't, but it probably will. And it'll probably go probably anywhere between 2 to 4 weeks, my guess of things. And the reason for that, again, is simply because of the clumsiness and the fact that you don't have an attorney on the other side representing the defendant.
You mentioned some of the evidence that's at play here. What do they have that's going to make this relatively turnkey?
The gun that was there that he left behind, the fact that it had a scope on it, the fact, you know, they got the manifesto, they have his writings, you know, the fact that he admitted that he didn't complete the job that he wanted to complete. I mean, he basically convicts himself by his words, his actions, and you have eyewitnesses seeing him go away in a car from that scene. So you have his words, you have his deeds, his acts, you have all the, you know, obvious things with the gun. It wasn't a toy gun. It wasn't a fake gun. It had the ability to shoot. It had a scope on it. It's just overwhelming. It's, you know, shooting fish in a barrel, so to speak. Again, it's just a slow plea. he should plead guilty. But, you know, he has a right to a trial. He has a constitutional right to be presumed innocent and go at it. But at the end of the day, there's just an avalanche of evidence against him.
I've seen enough episodes of Dateline and talked to you enough times to know that that seems like enough. That seems like enough information. Well, it's something we're going to continue to watch. Todd Flood, always appreciate the insight. Thank you.
I appreciate you too, my friends.
Yeah.
Enjoy your day.
Yeah, you do the
you
same.
You too.
But this is now getting underway. Whenever you're representing yourself, things probably aren't going to go well. Things probably aren't going to go
usually.
Smooth. Especially when you might be a crazy person. Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, the Pure Michigan Tour is off and running. We'll talk to the vice president of Pure Michigan next on JR Morning.
Well, this is one of the most successful campaigns out there. I mean, my friends who don't even live here know what Pure Michigan is. And Pure Michigan is announcing their fall campaign today. So what's new for this fall season? Let's ask Kelly Wolgamott, who is the vice president of Pure Michigan. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning, and thank you for having me this morning.
Thank you for joining us. We love talking about Pure Michigan and all that entails. So what's new for fall?
Oh, we're so excited. You know, there's nothing like a Pure Michigan fall day. And I know all of your listeners are really excited to get outdoors and enjoy the brilliant fall colors and just the really exceptional autumn experiences we have throughout the state. We are actually extending to a national audience an invitation to come visit us in Pure Michigan this fall. Of course, we're still marketing to the in-state and regional travelers, but we're at a national level, and that's a very important opportunity for the state. Typically, we have not gone out national in the fall time, but it gives us the opportunity to have the conversation out there that there is no place like Pure Michigan in the fall, and we can compete with any other state when it comes to fall colors.
No, last year I was in Portland, Maine for a wedding in October. And all I was hearing from people was, oh, you're going to love the colors in October in Maine. It's fantastic. And I got there and I'm like, yeah, this is fine. We have better colors in Michigan.
We do.
Making that pitch to people nationally, though, is really important. Changing that narrative.
It is. And, you know, we're a national product when it comes to summer. Mm-hmm. And again, our summers are outstanding. But it's time for also to us to get that recognition from fall to bring travelers to the state. Enjoy the stunning blues of our beautiful water. And then those paired with the red, oranges, and yellows of the fall trees are just incredible. And there's so much to see and do throughout the state in fall.
So it goes live today, correct?
We actually started targeting travelers in August. Mm. Oh. August 1st is when we started to get, outside of the state to inspire travelers to start thinking about that fall travel. And it's really a multi-sensory campaign where we started out with some incredible billboards in the Chicago market to inspire travelers to think about fall. And we actually had some artwork there that started as a summer campaign and then transitioned to fall colors. And it was truly incredible. And Chicago continues to be an incredible market for the state. But also we're starting now to be on Pandora. So you're going to see some unique initiatives when it comes to Pandora and talking about the colors, but also the culinary experiences that you can have throughout the state, to our agritourism with cider mills, corn mazes, and pumpkin patches, to having just, you know, the harvest and all of the agriculture we grow in the state, and going to some really unique restaurants. And I can't forget to mention the wine industry as well. So it's really a multi-sensory campaign that will be on radio, will be on digital TV, and really to get the attention and to inspire travelers to come visit us this fall.
How have these advertising campaigns changed nationally? We've seen a lot of different avenues now to put these messages. How has that changed? And a lot of the money that you guys get budgetarily, how has it changed for you guys?
Yeah, you know, we need to, the travel industry, think back, next year is our 20th anniversary for Pure Michigan, which is going to be an incredible year for us. And you think back when the campaign started and the competition wasn't there as it is today. You know, we have the competition not only from other states competing for our travelers, but also cities as well. And it really provides us the opportunity to be innovative and creative in how we approach the campaign and how we're going to target our audiences. So we do use a great mix. So we're on connected TV, on the Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus, but we're also utilizing efforts out of home. That's still a very effective opportunity for the brand. And nothing is more beautiful, right, than those great big Pure Michigan billboards to inspire travelers. And we're also looking at some unique opportunities. We partnered with Aroma Labs this year to come out with the Pure Michigan fragrance, seasonal fragrances. So we always are looking for opportunities that we can be a step ahead of the competition, but also ensuring that it's very meaningful and it's driving results to the state when it comes to economic impact.
Do you have data most recently of how this drives people to the state?
Sure. So, you know, we've had from over the summer in the month of July, specifically in some of our campaigns, we are able to do a quick measure to see how we are impacting travel. And the travel that we've impacted from year over year was up 175%, which is incredible, contributing over 35,000 specific trips that were brought into the state, but that's just a small portion of the campaign, and we're only able to measure a small portion of the campaign immediately, right? So we typically do an effectiveness every year. In 2024, we saw that the campaign, it continues to elevate the presence of Michigan, but it also, those individuals that are aware of the ad campaign stay longer time and number more nights in the state, but they also disperse throughout the state more and they experience more. So we will have the 25 data in a few months so that we'll be able to evaluate the campaign. But year over year, the campaign continues to be effective and meaningful in driving those travelers to the state. And I think we're seeing that too in our lodging report nationally. Lodging and the travel is down, but we've maintained in Michigan our month over month over the summer period. We were very much consistent with 24. We did not have a decline like other states did throughout the U.S.
Well, that's good news. And I'll tell you, I'm at michigan.org and the fall colors and
it's
videos
awesome.
On
it
that
got me hyped up.
Me too.
Yeah, it's
me too.
Got me hyped up.
All right, Kelly, good. We appreciate your time this morning, and we're happy that Pure Michigan moves forward.
Oh, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Very cool. No, I'm hyped.
I need
I'm
to
hyped.
Go see the colors. Although we're going to go on a college tour. We'll see some colors.
We'll see some colors. And the people rolling pumpkins down a hill. I've never done that before, but I'm in.
I'm sure my three-year-old also would be
love in. That, for sure.
And there's a button here on michigan.org for the kids, and they have
for the
ideas.
Kids, I also love, if you go down, scroll down on that, it's got the seasons. Right. So you just go, what are we doing next summer? Click it. Boom. Go. Plan it.
Like, you love the way this website is.
Love it.
Tailored.
I'm hyped up.
Excellent.
Let's go.
I can see it from back here that Jamie's looking at. I'm like, wow, that's a beautiful website.
This is what I'm saying. This is what I'm saying. Pretty cool.
Good job. Coming up, we're talking about a very important campaign when it comes to Forgotten Harvests. The good news coming up at 8:49.
All right, 8:49. Need you to be caller number 9 at 800-859-0957. 800-859-0WJR. If you are caller number 9, you get a pair of tickets to go see the Trans-Siberian Orchestra in concert. 760 WJR welcomes the Trans-Siberian Orchestra back to Little Caesars Arena for two shows. Saturday, December...
Couldn't do it.
3 p.m. It's never, again, it's too fast. It's too fast. It's too progressive. Saturday's December 27th at 3 p.m. And 7:30 this year to rock the powerhouse legendary holiday show, The Ghosts of Christmas Eve, The Best of TSO, and more, featuring a second set of hits and fan favorites, including a 25th anniversary salute to Beethoven's Last Night for a chance to win. Bonus chance. Text GHOSTS to 800-859-0957. Official contest rules are at WJR.com. Tickets on sale starting September 12th, a couple of days from now. It's Friday at 10 a.m. at Ticketmaster.com. Pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
So, you know, one of the things that we partner a lot with here on WJR is Forgotten Harvest. They do such great things. And Aaron Lewis, the CEO of Forgotten Harvest, joins us this morning. Adrian, it's good to have you back.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, and all the work that Forgotten Harvest does, it's so vitally important to our community.
Absolutely. You know, Forgotten Harvest, this is year 35 for us, Chris. And, you know, being around for the past 35 years and as we progress to definitely fight food insecurity and hunger throughout Metro Detroit, you know, we've grown to be the largest food rescue organization in the Midwest. And not to say that from a bragging perspective, but to say that from us being committed to fighting the need. And fighting those barriers that actually cause food insecurity throughout Metro Detroit.
How does the partnership with WJR help to get the word out, help to get dollars into Forgotten Harvest?
You know, you guys have been an amazing partner throughout the years, and your voice, your commitment to helping to solve this very critical problem has been amazing. And your listeners understand the need even better. Unfortunately, what we've experienced, you know, within the past few years is that, you know, the need continues to grow, though, right? And for you to be partnering with us to help us to not only understand the need and where it's coming from, but also what are some of the solutions? You know, for example, today we have a goal of providing 1 million meals. This Hunger Action Day. We wouldn't be able to do it without your voice.
Well, you're talking about 1 in 6 people that suffer from some sort of food insecurity, people that are hungry. And what I love about Forgotten Harvest is your commitment. I mean, you've got trucks on the road constantly, and this is nutritious meals that you're trying to give to people, nutritious food to try to nourish the soul, the body, everything.
Yes, yes. Thank you for pointing that out. I mean, we're talking, we rescue wholesome surplus foods and to be distributed throughout the community free of charge. I think that that's a big help, especially during what we're seeing is inflation continuing to show and rear its head, right? So how can we help those by giving them not a handout, but a hand up to get through these past times?
When is the action day that we're all going to step up and help?
Hey, you're in it right now.
We are in
it right now.
Today is the day.
We are in it. Today is the day. And every dollar donated to Forgotten Harvest, again, is going to provide 3 meals for our neighbors in need. And thanks to the Thomas and Carol Cracchiola Foundation, all donations, not only through today, but through September 30th, will be matched up to $30,000.
Wow.
Now, isn't that amazing?
So, yeah.
You know, that means that, you know, for our listeners and yourselves, that every dollar would go twice as far in providing those meals. And again, I believe with the help of yourselves and your listening audience that we can definitely achieve our goal and beyond our goal today of 1 million meals.
How big of a portion of your budget is this, these types of events, these fundraising events?
You know, it's exceeding over 40% of our budget.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's
absolutely
vital.
And it's vital. It is vital. And again, for us to be able to continue with our motto of, you know, making sure we're providing this service and this hand up free of charge to our community, it is vital. And not to mention, it takes a community to do this, right? It takes a village to do this. You know, we have hundreds of distribution partners throughout, partner agencies throughout Metro Detroit, the Tri-County area of Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb. And again, for us to be able to distribute that over 6 days a week, you know, it's impactful, right? And you mentioned the numbers that are alarming. 1 in 6 individuals are impacted by food insecurity and hunger. And that's over 170,000 children and 83,000 seniors. The most vulnerable.
Mm.
So this is really important.
You took it out of my mouth. I was wondering if you have an anecdote of someone who is helped by this and how it just warms your heart.
Yeah, you know, that to me is, you know, when you're talking children and seniors and anyone for that matter, you know, we're aimed to create programs, you know, that's going to fit that need of those vulnerable populations, which we're exiting our summer season. But, you know, over 668,000, I believe, meals went out to our community, to our children this summer. That's, you know what that looks like in the summer for some of our children in need. And our programs, such as the Forgotten Harvest Summer Lunch Program, coupled with the USDA Summer Meal Program, it has to happen each summer. And again, events like this helps with those tailwinds into that.
I say it all the time. Thank God for people like you, Adrian Lewis, leading a team of really dedicated people that are compassionate, that want to help the community through Forgotten Harvest. I hope there's one day when we don't need Forgotten Harvest, because that means people are being fed. But until that day comes, we know that you're going to be there and helping people in our community, the most vulnerable and people who just need a little extra help. We know that Forgotten Harvest is going to be there. Major day, $1 donated, get you a match. The goal here is to provide 1 million meals this Hunger Action Day. ForgottenHarvest.org to make that donation. Adrian Lewis, thank you so much. Really appreciate you.
Thank you. And I appreciate all you do to support our mission.
Of course.
And thank you, listening audience.
Yeah, of course. All right, that is going to do it for us today. Kevin Dietz and All Talk coming up next right here on WJR. Have a good one.